Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. This week's episode examines China's rise and the relative decline of the United States. Our speaker, Graham Allison, notes that historically, transitions of world power have often resulted in war between the rising and declining powers. In this hour, we'll hear from Graham Allison. He's the author of Destined for War, Can America and China Escape the Thucydides Trap? This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience, and this broadcast is made possible by the generous support of Chevron. And now to our moderator, Michael Nacht, of the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley.
Thank you. This is a special treat for me because more than 40 years ago, even though Graham and I are about the same age, I came to Harvard to be interviewed for a postdoctoral fellowship, and Graham was on the interview committee. And somehow he got bamboozled into thinking I was qualified, and we started to associate with each other at that time. The only thing you really have to know is that Graham, everything he does is worth paying attention to. Every one of his major books, Essence of Decision, Nuclear Terrorism, the book on Lee Kuan Yew, and now this book, are major statements and worth reading and reflecting upon. And the other thing is, in his spare time, he builds academic institutions in a way that I don't think any other university-based person has been able to do, certainly in the foreign policy and national security area. Both the Kennedy School writ large and the Belfer Center. So to say he's extraordinarily talented is a gross understatement. And you'll find out about this tonight. Graham has now published this new book, Destined for War, America, China, and Thucydides Trap. And we're going to hear from him about some of the many ideas in the book, which are really very important for all of us. So, Graham, if you permit me to begin, a simple question is, what is the essence of the book? What is the message of the book?
So first, let me say how pleased I am to be here in San Francisco, and especially with my good friend and colleague, Michael Nacht. We've become or been associated, as he said, for longer than either of us can remember, and have had a chance to work together in many arenas. He's always wonderfully generous, and so I'm happy to be back here at the World Affairs Council, where I've actually been a couple of times previously. But to this book, so just Destined for War, Can America and China Escape Thucydides Trap? This was just published last week, so this is part of the rollout. We were in New York and Washington last week, and then in Los Angeles yesterday, and then here today, and so forth. So this has been a little bit of a whirlwind. But there's a big idea in the book, and the big idea is Thucydides' trap. So when a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power, in general, bad stuff happens. This is a storyline that's as old as history itself. Indeed, the founder of history, as we know it, is Thucydides. So Thucydides was one of the great thinkers of classical Greece. And about 2,500 years ago, he wrote the first piece of recorded history, in which he tried to get the facts exactly right. And this was called the Peloponnesian War, and it was about the conflict between the two great city-states of classical Greece. And he wrote quite famously, and this is a line that you'll find in most any international relations course, quote, "It was the rise of Athens and the fear that this instilled in Sparta that made the war inevitable." So in this book, I try to take Thucydides' insight and apply it to help us understand what's happening in relations between the United States and China today. And I think if you want a lens or concept for helping clarify what's happening every day in the relationship between China and the U.S., Thucydides' trap is the place to look for it. So that if you think of it in terms of a lens for looking at phenomena, basically, if every day there's noise and news about what's happening in the relationship between U.S. and China. So there's missile tests in North Korea, or ships nearly collide in the South China Sea, or there's a dispute about an island in the East China Sea, or China, as you will see in your, you know, in your news feed, it becomes the number one trading partner of Germany or whatever. So every day, lots of news and lots of noise. But this lens helps kind of look beneath the surface of that to the structural reality, even the substructural reality, which is a dynamic between a rising power and a ruling power. And in the book, I look at the last 500 years. I find 16 cases in which this happened. 12 of them ended in war. In 4 cases, war was averted. So think of World War I as a case that ended in war. Rise of Germany, fear in Britain, conditions of Thucydidean stress, and then the assassination of an archduke becomes the match that burns down the whole house. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the 12. But in the case of the Cold War, which is a fascinating case, you have a surging Soviet Union, the threat of which is met by a remarkable strategy that basically became the framework that Michael and I spent most of our professional lives working within, and which ended successfully in 1991 with basically victory in the Cold War as the Soviet Union collapsed and disappeared. So that's a case of no war. It's called Cold War, but war there is a metaphor. It's only meant to be, it's every competition in every dimension except for bombs and bullets. So in my case, war means thousands of combatants killing each other, not Cold War. So I would say the big idea in this book is that we need to wake up to the reality that a rising China, which has risen so meteorically that most of us just simply don't get it. Okay? I have a good chapter in the book that basically I think is a capsule for people that haven't followed this development recently about the rise of China.
That's my second question.
Okay, well, basically that, this event and the impact that it's having on us and on the international order is the way to think about the challenge and the risks, not for the purpose of fatalism or for pessimism, but because you got to understand what the problem is if you're going to be able to face it.
Now, you do have this really startlingly interesting chapter early in the book, even for those for the readers who think they're familiar with the rise of China. I think you'll find some amazing statistics and trends in that chapter about just what the juggernaut of China's economic strength means. Do you want to cite a few examples?
Sure. I think as I start the chapter with a discussion of a real event. So shortly after David Petraeus became director of CIA, and Petraeus had been the general that oversaw the surge. I think he's America's most successful modern general, and somebody I've known since he was a graduate student at Princeton a long time ago. So a couple of weeks after he had become director of CIA, I went to visit him. And I say in the book, this is how the chapter opens, I said to him, how do you like this? Oh, David is always enthusiastic about everything. It's great. These people are so inventive and whatever. And I said, well, have they begun opening for you some of the jewel boxes? And he's looking at, I said, you know, those are the secrets that CIA knows that nobody else knows, okay, and that they told you they would have to kill you. So so he said, yes, okay. And I said, well, have they introduced you to any of the product from deep sleepers. And he's looking, okay, you know, very interesting. What? And I said, you mean these folks that actually the agency established a relationship with long ago and doesn't call in often, but from time to time, maybe every year or 5 years or sometimes 10 years, ask them. They go into their own societies. They succeed in their own way. But where the U.S. needs to understand what's going on in one of their societies, and we ask them questions and they give answers. And he was looking at me, you know, like, I don't know about this. So I pulled out from my briefcase about a 50-page memo. And I said, for example, I brought one. Oh, now he was almost across the table. And I said, I put some questions to one, and here I have his answers. Okay? And so the first question, are China's current leaders, including Xi Jinping, current leaders, serious about displacing the U.S. as the predominant power in the foreseeable future? Well, he's looking. And I said, well, what has CIA told you? And he said, well, you know, they had an estimate on this just last week. And it says, on the one hand, on the other hand, it's very complicated, you know. And I said, well, here's his answer. Of course. Why not? Who could expect otherwise? How could they not aspire to be the dominant power in Asia and in time in the world? So next question. What is their strategy for achieving this objective? Next question. Do you think they're going to succeed? Next question. How are they going to behave when they become number one? So I went through about seven questions like this, and he grabbed this piece of paper, you know, give me this paper. Okay, let me look at it. So this was Q&As with Lee Kuan Yew. Right. Lee Kuan Yew was the founder and builder of Singapore. He took a little rock and made it into a country that's a modern megapolis. Currently today has a per capita income higher than the U.S. So it's an amazing story. But Lee Kuan Yew was not, let me be clear, not a CIA-related person. Not at all. Not at all. Lee Kuan Yew was his own man completely. But he was the world's premier China watcher. And he was the world's premier China watcher in part because he lived in a little country right next door, which he understood survives at the forbearance of this big neighbor. And secondly, because he was a great strategist with great insight. And thirdly, because every Chinese leader from Deng Xiaoping to Xi Jinping called Lee Kuan Yew mentor and came to him to ask him questions. So he had spent thousands of hours with these leaders in a way that no intelligence officer or academic who's trying to write about this could ever possibly imagine. And I had the good fortune to have him, in effect, as a tutor in writing this Lee Kuan Yew book about China. So in any case, his big message about China was, you Americans are not going to get it. You just can't get it. This is the biggest player in the history of the world. And the idea that people whom you've looked down on and despised and don't regard as kind of your type, or non-Westerners even, could become the biggest player in the world. It's just too hard. So I, in the book, I offer several illustrations, but I'll just give a couple for fun. As Michael knows, every Harvard person's, there's probably some Harvard people here, every Harvard presentation is essentially self-referential. Okay. So there's a bridge at Harvard that goes across the Charles River between the business school and the Kennedy School. And that the discussion about the reconstruction of this bridge began while I was dean, and I quit being dean in 1988. Okay. This project began in 2012, and it was a 2-year project to reconstruct the bridge. And I know about this a lot because I sit in the traffic jam that's created by this construction project. So now they've given up on the date on when it's just going to be completed. So when you say completion date, now it just says question mark. Okay. It's 3 times over budget. And this is, now I'm sure in California there are no construction projects like that. But in any case, this is one I see every day. So I know this. It's called the Anderson Bridge. You can go Google it. You can see it. So in China, in Beijing, there's a bridge called the Sanyuan Bridge. It is twice as big as the Anderson Bridge. And it was reconstructed in 2013. Mm-hmm. And you can go Google this. Mm-hmm. So how long did it take to reconstruct the Sanyuan Bridge? Just take a guess.
2 months.
How much?
2 weeks, he said.
43 hours. 43 hours. If I had a slideshow here, I would I'd show you the video. You can go to YouTube and you can watch it. It's got a time stamp on it. Now, of course, they work at night, you know, and they seem to work hard. But I'm telling you, you can drive across that bridge. I've driven across it. Works fine. And if I could get them to come and fix the Anderson Bridge in 43 hours now, I would be very grateful. Okay. So we have never as a country risen so far, so fast on so many different dimensions. I give you one more quiz here. So I have in the book an abbreviated version of a quiz I give the students in my course at the Kennedy School, where Michael used to teach. It says, when could China become number one? And I have 26 indicators. So number one, automobile manufacturer. Number one, smartphone manufacturer. Number one, number of billionaires. Number one, supercomputers. Number one, artificial intelligence. Number one. So we have 26 indicators. So students, then I say, for each one, you have to write in. So I give a quiz out. They have to write down the date. So one said 2040, you know, not in my lifetime, whatever. Then I have a second chart I put up on the board. It says, already. So every one of these 26 indicators. So if you ask Americans, or indeed if you read in your newspapers, what is the biggest economy in the world? You could find in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times today, the U.S. But if you ask the IMF or if you ask CIA, the headline from the IMF World Bank meeting in 2014 was China has become the largest economy in the world, measured by purchasing power parity, which is the yardstick that CIA and IMF think is the best single yardstick for comparing national economies. So that means already. So I quote Václav Havel, the former president of the Czech Republic, in which he says, things have happened so fast, we haven't yet had time to be astonished.
Well, I think that gives the audience a flavor for the nature of the problem here, and also the fascination of the book. I have to insert a little Berkeley anecdote. Harvard's not alone in being self-referential. There's a famous Berkeley story where a professor visits with a major donor, and for 2 hours the professor just talks about himself to the donor. Then he realizes he's there, you know, to get some funds from the donor. So he says to the donor, okay, enough about me. What did you think of my book?
I think this must be a Harvard story.
Yeah. It may have been a Harvard story, stolen by Berkeley. So in the book, Graham, you say conflict, however, is not inevitable, and probably it might start in an unplanned or non-strategic fashion. You have a whole section on that. Can you give us some examples of how inadvertent conflict could begin between these two powers?
So Michael always puts these questions so modestly, but that goes right to the heart of the matter. So most of the audience here today can't even imagine that there could be a war between the U.S. and China because it's so crazy. I mean, it just makes no sense. And it makes no sense, for sure. And is there anybody in Washington who thinks a war with China is a good idea? No, I don't think not a single person. Is there anybody in China and in Beijing, in the Ministry of Defense, that's planning, I think now is a good time for a war with the U.S.? No, absolutely not. So if you sit down, any of the folks that are involved in making choices, they have a clear in their mind that a war would be just unthinkable. We just, I mean, the level of devastation would be just unimaginable. So therefore, war cannot occur. No, wrong. Go back to 1914. So what was happening 100 years ago, actually today, one was in the third year of World War One, and the U.S. had actually just entered, just in April of 1917. So in the summer of 1914, most of you will remember vaguely, a Archduke of the Austria-Hungarian Empire went to Sarajevo and was assassinated by a Serbian terrorist from a group called the Black Hand. Now, if you were writing a novel, you could hardly make this up, okay? The consequence of this sets in motion a set of actions and reactions, at the end of which all the nations of Europe are at war with each other. And at the end of the war, the devastation is so great that historians are forced to create a whole new category for describing it. World War. That's why it's called World War One. So there was not something like this before. So you look and you say, wait a minute, let me see. An archduke is assassinated, and all these countries decide to find themselves in a war, and a war in which, at the end of which, everyone has lost what he was trying to hold on to that led to the war. So, end of the war, 1918. Austro-Hungarian Empire is dissolved, it's gone. And the emperor, gone. The Russian Tsar, who's backing the Serbs, his whole regime has been overthrown by the Bolsheviks, the communists. So he's gone. And his government, his kind of government is gone. The monarchy, gone. Okay. The Kaiser in Germany is backing his buddy in Vienna. He's tossed out, gone. Okay. France has been bled of its youth for a whole generation, never recovers as a society. And Britain, which has been a great creditor country for a century, is now a debtor, heavily in debt and in terminal decline. So if you had an opportunity, if you'd given people a chance for a do-over, nobody would have made the choices they made. Yeah. But they made the choices they made, and the consequences occurred. So if I look at, for example, what's happening on the Korean Peninsula today, it smells to me a lot like 1914. I mean, could Kim Jong-un test an ICBM that CIA will say could deliver a nuclear warhead against San Francisco? Yes, he could. Yes, he could. And could Donald Trump order an attack on the launching pad or on the missile when it's on the launching pad in order to prevent that? Yes, he could. Well, I would say, think about this as two trains coming down, you know, tracks, almost like the Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion. So the Kim Jong-un's train is coming down the track, conducting tests, which have already allowed him to have nuclear weapons, then allowed him to have missiles that can deliver nuclear weapons against South Korea, then give him missiles that can deliver nuclear weapons against Japan, and now he just one more step can deliver nuclear weapons against San Francisco. And Trump has said, from the first time he ever heard of this. So he had heard of this from Obama when he was president-elect and met with Obama as president. And Obama said, you know, this North Korean crisis is going to be a big, big crisis. Trump said he never heard of it before. Okay, so he went out immediately and tweeted and said, not going to happen. Under Trump, this is not going to happen. It might happen under Obama, might happen under Bush, might happen under Clinton, not me. Okay. And at Mar-a-Lago, where he had the summit just a month ago with China's leader Xi Jinping, he said to him, and he said it very clearly, he said, look, you can solve this problem. But if you don't solve this problem, I can solve this problem. But you're not going to like the way I solve it. And then after the chocolate cake was served at the dinner, he excused himself to go and announce that we were striking Syria with 50 Tomahawk missiles, just in case you didn't get the message. Yes? So I would say, watch this space. Yeah.
Now, some readers of the book who may be a bit more skeptical about the march toward war would say, even if this Thucydides trap has prevailed in 12 out of 16 cases, what's new now are nuclear weapons. And you do address that in the book. What is it about nuclear weapons that might forestall such a conflict, and why, even with the presence of nuclear weapons, might conflict occur?
Okay. Thank you. That's Michael and I were chatting earlier because he and I both have been fascinated by and worked on problems of nuclear weapons all our professional careers, and he's writing a book on the topic now, which I look forward to seeing. So I think I say in the book, and it's a kind of a grotesque metaphor, but I think it captures the point because the situation is grotesque, that when two states acquire not just nuclear weapons but arsenals robust enough that after I've done my best to disarm you, you still have enough capability to destroy me, that's what was in the Cold War called mutual assured destruction, MAD. And it is a form of madness because basically you're threatening, or you're in a relationship in which you're so codependent that if one of the party dies as a result of the attack from the first, the attacker dies. So I say, think about this as if you wake up one morning and you have your own head and your own arms and your own legs, but your backbone and your respiratory system has just been fused with another guy, so Michael and me. Okay? And we're now Siamese twins. Now, however mischievous I am, however evil I am, however dangerous I am, however deserving of being strangled, every time Michael thinks, okay, you bastard, it's time to strangle you, he thinks, yeah, that's a good idea, except that I'll be at the same time committing suicide. That's not a good idea. So if I could find a way to kill you, I would, but I can't do it without killing myself, and so this has a stabilizing effect because people, you know, begin to be more cautious. They also I have to compromise with you a little bit. If you want to do something dangerous, I have to try to somehow persuade you not to do. So this provides, in effect, a bedrock of a partnership that unless I can find a way to escape, I have to live with. So that had an important part of the... That was an important part of the ballast in the relationship between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the Cold War, and is, I think, in the Chinese case. In addition, you have an economic component where there's a lot of a high degree of economic entanglement that can play a significant part in this picture. And there's climate. Again, not everybody subscribes to this theory, but I think all the scientific community... And all the people who've looked at it in a serious ways recognize that the current pattern of greenhouse gas emissions from the energy that we use may succeed in creating a climate 100 years from now where our great-great-great-grandchildren won't even be able to survive. So if we Americans do everything we could conceivably do to address the problem and Chinese do nothing, the problem cannot be solved. And vice versa, if Chinese were to do everything they could do and we'd say we'll just continue our pattern, no solution. So either can jointly solve that problem or the problem won't be solved. So I would say there's enough ingredients to try to work with if you were trying to construct a relationship between the U.S. and China to have a lot of areas of cooperation. At the same time, there's the other side of the balance sheet where lots of areas in which we will find a competitive interest. So from a Chinese perspective, when they look out and see the U.S. Navy patrolling their border or their territorial border or serving as the arbiter in the South China Sea, they think that seems anomalous. But I, as I mentioned in the book, a Chinese Navy person whom I know well says, you know, you worry about a prospect of a collision between the U.S. and the Chinese Navy. He said, there's no chance of a collision between the U.S. and Chinese Navy in the Caribbean because we're not there. So the only reason why there's a risk of a collision in the South China Sea is that you have ships there. And he said, besides, what's the name of this? Look at your map. What's the name of this body of water that is adjacent to us? It's called the South China Sea. It's not called the American Sea. So why are the Americans there? And I say to him, wait a minute. We've been there to provide the economic and security order for 70 years that has allowed you to grow big, strong, and you've had the fastest growth in your whole 5,000-year history and a long period of peace. And who provided that for you? We did. That was the American-built international order. You should be grateful for this. Maybe you should even pay for it, okay, or help pay for it. They say, well, forget about it. That was then. Now it's now. Time for you to butt out. So I would say there's areas for competition, even though there's plenty of areas in which we have shared interests.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Graham Allison, author of Destined for War, Can America and China Escape the Thucydides Trap? This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. Ours is a membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. And now back to our moderator, Michael Nacht.
One final brief, it's an important question, but just briefly, you do cite in the book, based upon examining the four cases where there was no conflict, some clues as to how to avoid conflict as the U.S.-China relationship continues to mature. Do you want to just give the audience a few examples, and then we'll turn to the audience for their questions and comments?
Well, I have a chapter called 12 Clues for Peace, and it's got a number of items, but I'd say the short version is, if I did four, I would say, first, clarify American vital interests. Sam Nunn has a good line that distinguish between the vital and the vivid. So many things are vivid that are not vital. So not everything that we've currently been doing is vital for the U.S. So have a hierarchy of interests. Some things are vital. Hold to what's vital, but be prepared to adapt and adjust with respect to things that matter less. How much do we really care about a particular island in the South China Sea or whether somebody constructs an island, for example? So secondly, appreciate or be more clear-eyed about what China wants. China wants to be great. I have a chapter on what Xi's China wants. And long before Donald Trump made Make America Great Again his banner, Xi Jinping in 2012 had announced his plan, which is colloquially is to make China great again. It's called the Great Rejuvenation of the Great Chinese People. Now, from the Chinese perspective, China was great forever, 5,000 years. Then there was this anomaly the last 200 years, where Westerners came and exploited China, imperialized China, interfered in it. And that's a problem. But if you back off, and as they back off, China will reemerge to be China the way it ever was, which is great, and the dominant power in its region. So understand that's the Chinese objective. That's the Chinese vision. That's deeply rooted in Chinese culture. And it's not crazy, okay? It may be objectionable to us, but it's not crazy. In fact, I have a lively chapter which most Americans may not like as much, but in which I say, what if Xi's China was just like us? Because Americans, Michael and I have both been government officials in which American government officials especially love to preach to or give speeches to foreigners about why they should be more like us, okay? Responsible and whatever, okay? When Teddy Roosevelt, which is the chapter on if Xi's China was just like us, reads the story through Teddy Roosevelt's eyes, when he became the number two person in the Navy in 1897 and was supremely confident that the century ahead was going to be an American century. So how did we behave? And I would take you too long here, but I would say, look at the chapter, you'll see. If China behaved like that, forget about it. The war will be 100% likely. 100% likely. We created a new country by sponsoring a coup in Colombia. That's how we got to Panama, which gave us a contract for our canal. We actually stole most of the fat tail of Alaska, where I go fishing. Okay, it's a good story in the book about that. So in any case, so two is understand China. Three would be find areas in which we can build constructively, jointly, and would therefore create a framework in which then the areas where inevitably there'll be conflicts or where third parties' actions may impact us can be managed. But there's 12 clues for peace. Maybe that's enough to get started. Yeah.
Well, there are many interesting observations and questions from our audience. Let me just offer a few. One country, one leader that you haven't dwelled on very much is Putin and Russia. And they present a whole other set of characteristics, capabilities, point of view, with global interests and aspirations. Again, maybe slightly different than prior historical examples. Where do the Russians and Putin factor in to the possibility of U.S.-China conflict?
That's a very interesting question. And how does it fit in this Thucydides and dynamic? So,
and would they want a conflict?
Yes.
Would they try to induce a conflict?
Perhaps. I think the I've been a student of Russia for a long time, too. But I'm very puzzled by Russia. But in any case, I think the general picture in the American discussion, and especially in the press, but in fact in the policy conversation too, about the relationship between China and Russia is mainly misguided, in my view. So the general narrative says these two nations can't get on with each other because they are natural adversaries as opposed to aligned, since they share this huge long border, since half of Russia is not populated, but it's full of resources in Siberia, and the Chinese have a huge number of people that need both space and resources. So just over the long run, this doesn't look like a happy relationship. And I would say over the long run, that's true. But how about in the short run, like next decade or two decades? And in the current situation, and the next decade, I suspect, China and Russia, particularly in the persons of Xi Jinping and Putin, are best buddies. So the first person Xi Jinping went to visit when he became president was Putin. Every event that Xi Jinping has, Putin shows up. So, for example, a week before last at this One Belt, One Road event mm-hmm. in Beijing or in Shanghai, she spoke first. The person that spoke second was Putin. When she and Putin get together, what do they talk about? The U.S., their common adversary, and particularly about a U.S. that they both agree is trying to undermine them and their regime, which to some extent we are, since we basically are in favor of democracies, and both of them are trying to manage autocracies. So I think that alignment is quite interesting. On the other hand, Putin cares most about Russia and Putin, and Xi cares most about China and Xi. So I think when Putin is fooling around in Ukraine and the U.S. is focused there, Xi thinks that's great. And when Xi has got the U.S. attention, Putin thinks that great. So if you ended up having a conflict between the U.S. and China, I suspect Putin would take advantage of the situation because he would expect that we would be distracted.
A different historical analogy that a few folks have raised here are the Japanese rise in the 30s from economically backward in the 19th century to rising economic power, nationalist power. Attractiveness to that analogy, or are they really, you know, Japan rising in the 30s, the U.S. imposes an oil embargo, there's ultimately Pearl Harbor and war. Is there any relevance to lessons learned from that analogy, or is it pretty far removed from what you think is
important? I think that's one of the great cases in the book. So in the book, every one of the cases we have a little short account of in the appendix. So it's potted history. I mean, three pages to tell the story of the rise of Japan and the answer. That's a little short. Actually, on the Thucydides Trap case file, which is a website, if you go to, there's longer versions of the cases and also references to other authoritative discussions of the cases. But the rise of Japan in the 30s is a great case, I think, and very relevant now. So basically, Japan over the late 20s and the 30s grew rather rapidly and became quite aggressive in the region, and including basically invading and taking over large parts of China. The U.S. was maintaining at the time what we had established when Roosevelt was there, the so-called open door policy. So we were the guarantors of the order in the region. In the 30s, Japan became even more aggressive. The U.S. first had a trade constraints, and then ultimately an embargo. And then right before 1940, actually an embargo on oil, all oil shipments to Japan. Now, from the American point of view, this looked like we were simply trying to put some constraints on a country that was being unduly aggressive, and especially in China. But from the Japanese point of view, this looked like we were trying to strangle them and strangle their economy. So we didn't appreciate what the consequences of the economic trade war and ultimately embargoes were going to be. And under those conditions, Japan decided to attack Pearl Harbor. And the thought that Japan would attack Pearl Harbor, the U.S. was, I don't know, 7-8 times larger in GDP than Japan at the time. And Yamamoto, the guy who planned the attack, said to the emperor, "I'm telling you, I can execute an exquisite attack, and it'll be very successful, and I think I will be very successful against the Americans for 6 months. But if the war lasts longer than that, we'll lose." So they understood their situation. The question is, do you want to be strangled now, or do you want to take a chance on maybe I attack you and maybe it doesn't go beyond 6 months, and maybe you get tired and maybe you go away, or maybe you get entangled in Europe or otherwise. So if it's hard to imagine a trade war ending with atomic weapons exploding on the territory of somebody's soil, I think one ought to go back and look at that story, because that war ended with Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I believe it was the case that you published a piece in The Atlantic citing a number of these ideas before the Mar-a-Lago meeting, and Xi Jinping was actually asked about his own views about the Thucydides trap and said that he would make sure to avoid it. Any reflections on the fact that your ideas have reached the leader of China?
Well, we're hoping that he... this book has been like 5 years in the making. So as Michael knows, books mature in different, paces, and I've been I have a day job as well, so there's a little bit of competition back and forth. I published an article version of this in 14. But in any case, the Chinese picked up on it quite early, and Xi Jinping is very interested in the idea. It turns out that actually his chief economic assistant is a fellow named Liu He, and he was a student of mine at the Kennedy School about 20 years ago. So I know him and we talk, and he's very interested in history and history lessons. And the Chinese actually are much more interested in history than Americans tend to be. So they, so Xi Jinping has wrestled with this idea a lot and talks about it often, arguing, and I think properly, that there's no necessity for someone to be caught in Thucydides' trap, that that it requires additional mistakes, there's no inevitability to this. And I agree with that very strongly. I say in the book that basically business as usual will likely produce history as usual, but as the line says, only those who fail to study history are condemned to repeat it. So there's no reason why we can't avoid mistakes that have been made before and learn lessons from the positive cases.
There has been some public debate here that maybe the Chinese economic miracle is going to run into trouble, that the rate of increase of GDP will slow. They have huge debt, which is rising. And even this Silk Road maritime and land strategy may be more rhetoric than reality. So any sense that we are overestimating the long-term power of the Chinese economic dominance in the world?
So obviously, yes, okay, I would say this is a good question. And about the future, nobody knows. Okay. So how in the world has an economy grown at essentially double digits for almost three decades? Nobody else ever did that before. So can they continue that forever? Of course not. So there's a famous law by an economist that says a trend that cannot continue forever won't. So on the other hand, it's very much easier to predict that something will happen than when. So 10 years ago, most people said, well, this can't continue. 5 years ago, this can't continue. Larry Summers and I co-chair a China working group at the Welfare Center. And every year, he thinks this is the year that you're going to see the slowdown. Every year I'm bullish with respect to China, so at least for the last 5 years, I've each year won that bet. I'm somewhat influenced, or probably maybe overly influenced, by Lee Kuan Yew's judgment about it. And his argument was he didn't see any reason why they couldn't continue growing at roughly three times the rate of the U.S. for as far as you could see. Think of it. It's just you can do the math. So if Chinese were only one quarter as productive as Americans, given that they have four times as many people, then you have two economies that are the same size. So maybe suppose they were just half as productive as we were. Well, then they would be twice as big. So will they always be only half as productive as we are? Well, when I look and see what they're doing, certainly if it's fixing a bridge, they look like they can do it, maybe even faster. So I think they, on the other hand, if you look at, when I talked to Liu He, he has a list of 19 challenges that China is trying to face, each one of which just looks overwhelming. And so they are not unrealistic about the fact that they have terrible, terrible problems. You can't breathe the air half of the time in Beijing. Well, that's crazy in there. But they then say, okay, we're going to try to work on the problem, and they begin working on it. They mobilize the instruments that they have. And the competence that the government has demonstrated, I think, is impressive if you compare it with the performance of other governments.
One other state that several people cite that you haven't really discussed is India. India is huge. It has a rapid growth rate now, too. It's been historically a rival of China. They fought several border wars. Where might India fit into this Thucydides trap between the U.S. and China?
That's a great question. I haven't wrestled with that one sufficiently. So one of the big differences between the emergence of China and the emergence of the U.S., to rival and then ultimately surpass Britain at the beginning of the 20th century, was that in our hemisphere, there were no competitors. So basically, I mean, everybody else was small and weak. In the Chinese case, they're emerging as a major power in Asia, and you already have Japan there. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. Japan has a very substantial military. So that's a factor to take into account. And then there's India with its promise, with a population as large, perhaps soon to be larger than China, and which if it could get its act together and were able to grow at a very rapid rate for any sustained period of time, which it may do, then the situation could adapt. Lee Kuan Yew was pretty pessimistic about India, and I may be unduly influenced by, again, his views. He argued that the combination of the caste system, which is the rigid bureaucracy of the absence of any common language except for English. And in fact, in the Lee Kuan Yew book, which is I did jointly with a colleague, Bob Blackwell, who had been the President Bush's ambassador to India when the strategic partnership was developed. And we were this was a little bit of malice of forethought because I had seen Lee Kuan Yew's views about India earlier once. So we were interviewing him for this book, and we asked the question, well, many people say India is going to overtake China. What do you think? And he said, forget about it. He said, India is not a real country. And Blackwell almost fell off of his chair. He said, it really is just a collection of independent satrapies that are unified only by the British Railroad. That was his view, not mine. Okay.
In the book, you have a chapter on Clash of Civilizations, and that really what we're talking about here in Sino-American relations may be a clash between two fundamentally different cultures. And you have this very provocative table, which I'll just summarize briefly, and maybe this is just a reinforcement of your thesis. Self-perception, America sees itself as number one, China, center of the universe. America's core value is freedom, China's is order. America's view of government is a necessary evil, China's is a necessary good. America's form of government, democratic republic, China's responsive authoritarianism. Americans view foreigners inclusively, at least until recently. China views them exclusively. America's time horizon is now, China's time horizon is eternity. America's foreign policy is based on international order, China on harmonious hierarchy. That sounds like a set of really fundamentally different worldviews deeply embedded in two different cultures. Is that, in some sense, at the core of your concern about potential conflict between the two?
Well, it's a good question, and so I would say yes and no. Basically, the Thucydidean dynamic occurs as a fundamental dynamic independent of culture in the first instance. So Athens and Sparta were both spoke Greek.
Culture.
They were both Britain and Germany. The Kaiser and the king were cousins, I mean, the Kaiser's favorite person in the world was Queen Victoria, his grandmother. And he would dress up in he was so proud of the uniform she gave him of a British naval admiral. He would dress up in the uniform, you know, for the regatta. A culture is a independent variable, but in the case of U.S. and China, I think the clash of civilizations exacerbates the differences because not only does one have the basic structural stress that Thucydides taught us about, but the misunderstandings that occur in all Thucydidean dynamics are exaggerated more, because when I say things should be the way they should be, I think of them through American eyes, and the Chinese think through them, and through Chinese eyes. And I think you see this most importantly in the domain of order. So Americans have a strange idea of order, which is that everybody's equal, citizens have their rights, and then there's some process by which we then, through a democratic system, govern ourselves. For Chinese, this looks like chaos. Now, actually, maybe for some Americans, it'll come to, if it's not looking as good as it would have maybe sometime before. But in any case, from a Chinese perspective, order comes from hierarchy. And hierarchy means there's somebody at the top of the hierarchy, and then there's somebody beneath them, and then there's somebody beneath them. And the principle in the primal injunction in Confucian culture says, know thy place. So that means, where am I on this pecking order? That's where I belong. And from a Chinese perspective, I, China, the middle kingdom, the center of the universe, belong at the top of this pyramid. And other people belong. So when we explain, and I think people who were romantic about the democratization of China back 10 years ago or 20 years ago, Tiananmen, for example, thinking, okay, well, they're just going to be just like us. And I think there's some degree of truth in the fact that human beings have many things that they want in common, but Chinese, and certainly the Chinese leadership's conception of order, is not democracy. Whereas if in our structure, when we see the elements of oligarchy or that look like oligarchy, we, most Americans, think that's bad, but that's supposed to be equality of people. So I think the culture clash actually exacerbates the misunderstandings that would otherwise be there in any case.
Well, this is all the time we have tonight. On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I ask you to join me in thanking Graham Allison.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Please visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Graham Allison. He's the author of Destined for War, Can America and China Escape the Thucydides Trap? He was in conversation with Michael Nacht of the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.